This year we decided on what if for our theme. The discussion started around how science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction frequently present what if scenarios to us. The plots often ask us to think about questions like, what if we were to continue with this current trend? Whether that trend is political or economic, cultural or social, scientific or spiritual. What would the future look like if we continued what we're doing presently? Or alternatively, the plot may reflect, what would it look like if we went down this other path where we would end up in a different future? After discussing this for a while, the worship team realized that other types of fiction also present opportunities to explore what if questions, so we broadened the theme to include those. Finally, we thought, what if we just leave the possibilities wide open? And that's where we ended up with a general what if. When the team was first talking about the options found in science fiction and fantasy, the stories that first came to my mind were some of Ursula Le Guin's tales. Some of her stories focus on social and political themes, and she liked to explore alternative political, social, and economic structures in her tales. And so, because my service would be on July 4th, I decided to talk about various ideas of freedom, how they've shown up in our nation's history and they still play out today. And I will use some of Le Guin's stories to illustrate and compare some differing views. Today we celebrate the nation's birthday, Independence Day. On the 4th of July, Americans often congregate to barbecue, drink beer, and then blow stuff up. Hopefully this year there won't be too much of the blowing stuff up because of the extreme fire danger, but because of some people's views of their freedoms, I'm not holding my breath. Our Revolutionary War was fought for independence from the monarchy of Great Britain. That's one kind of freedom, the freedom to decide we needed to be a separate nation, to make our own choice about who we wanted to be, to choose our own form of government and live with the consequences. We made a revolutionary choice. We, the people, would govern ourselves in a constitutional republic. From the beginning, it was an experiment, and we have to admit we're still not sure how this experiment will turn out. We tend to toss the word freedom around, well, freely in our national dialogue. Most early Americans and those today would be united in the idea of national freedom, freedom to make our own choices as an independent nation. But they would not necessarily be in agreement about political freedoms, economic freedoms, social freedoms, or individual freedoms. The framers of our Constitution gathered in 1787 to attempt to fix the government that had been set up by the original Articles of Confederation, a government which was not working well at all because it had little power. It couldn't regulate commerce or print money or enforce much of anything. Disputes among the states over taxation, trade, territory, and war pensions were threatening to tear the country apart. Even those who gathered to fix this started out wary of strong centralized government. Even though they started out wary of strong centralized government, they ended up designing a much more powerful government. This is really a question of how much freedom states and individuals would have, and they realized that the young nation would not survive without a stronger central government. Despite all their divisive views and interests, they cobbled together compromises into an extraordinary document. Along the way, they had to work around and find ways to evade some questions in order to come to any agreement. One of the difficult questions, of course, that they evaded was what to do about slavery. If they had tried to take that head on at that point, the Union would probably have been derailed, and who knows what the future would have been. They decided it was better to create a strong, although imperfect, document then to stabilize the nation. Changes and guarantees of specific freedoms could be added later. Historian David Hackett Fisher, in his 2005 book, Liberty and Freedom, wrote this: "What made America free was not any single vision of liberty and freedom, but the interplay of many visions. Together, these many ideas made America more free than any one American ever was or wished to be." Early European settlers on this continent brought with them these multiple visions of what freedom meant that came out of their own cultural, religious, and political backgrounds and histories. Fisher wrote about the viewpoints of four important immigrant groups that came from four distinct regions of Britain. The Puritans, for example, came to New England from East Britain seeking religious freedom, the freedom to serve God and the world in their own fashion. Within their communities, that freedom was restricted to themselves, however, Fisher says. They spoke of soul freedom, liberty of conscience, but didn't extend it even very far to other Protestants within that culture. Freedom for Puritans mostly meant what they called ordered liberty, which meant there were lots of individual restraints on them, but restraints imposed by that community, not by outsiders. Liberty meant the right not to be interfered with without the community's consent. This idea became an important spark in setting off the Revolutionary War, and we continue to see it throughout our history in arguments of states' rights and local communities' rights against infringement by centralized government. From the south of England came wealthy cavaliers along with their indentured servants to settle in Virginia. They understood freedom as the power to rule and not be ruled by others. Freedom was based entirely on their social hierarchy. The wealthy plantation owners at the top had plenty of freedom. For them, the role of the state was seen as minimal. They would have the power to rule themselves. Their idea of freedom also included dominion over the self, the Stoic idea of duty over personal choice. So it's freedom tempered by duty. Those at the lower levels of the social hierarchy had less freedom until you got down to the indentured servants and the slaves on which the wealthy depended. Freedom didn't make it that far down the hierarchy. I think we probably have a pretty good idea of the servants' and slaves' conceptions of freedom. Freedom would mean having control of your own life and being accorded the same worth and dignity, the same choices as other human beings, just as Mombette wanted in Christine's story. Throughout our history and today, we can see the effects of this hierarchical view of freedom, as well as the intention of the wealthy people at the top to not be ruled by a federal government. The next group, Quakers, came from the northern Midlands in England to the mid-Atlantic colonies. The Quakers also rejected the idea of strong government, but believed in what they called reciprocal liberty. Freedom was extended to everyone. The Liberty Bell, commissioned by the Quakers, took its inscription from the biblical book of Leviticus. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof. They extended all the liberties they claimed for themselves to everyone. Liberty of conscience was seen as very important by them, not because they were encouraging a diversity of beliefs, but in the optimistic belief that Christian truth would triumph over error eventually if everyone was allowed to think for themselves. This belief in freedom of conscience became important in establishing later guarantees of freedom of religion as well as freedom of thought and the press. We UUs find it today in our principles, where we affirm a free and responsible search for truth and meaning and the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. The fourth group came from North Britain and the turbulent borderlands. They immigrated to the backcountry, the westernmost regions of the colonies, often settling in the mountains. They were poor, proud, and tended to be warlike. Their religion has been described as a militant, violent brand of decentralized Presbyterian Christianity. They didn't trust outsiders and had contempt for all government. Law and order was not a strong value for them. They continued for many years to be violent with a tendency toward blood feuds. They hated constraints of any kind. Think of Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. Their symbol was not a bell, it was a snake, a rattlesnake. The rally cry was, don't tread on me. Notice it's not, don't tread on us. It's very much oriented toward their individual rights. It seems they didn't develop much concept of the common good. Throughout our history, this has been an important strain of American thought and continues today. We see it every day on the news. The one saying, the state doesn't have any right to make me wear a mask, or I'll shoot off fireworks on my land if I want to and nobody can stop me. Of course, there have been other immigrant groups, each bringing their cultural histories with them to add to the creative tension that surrounds the idea of freedom in this country. Quoting David Hackett Fisher again, he said, the most important fact about American liberty is that it has never been a single idea, but a set of different and even contrary traditions in creative tension with each other. This diversity of libertarian ideas has created a culture of freedom which is more open and expansive than any unitary tradition alone could possibly be. While this creative tension among views of freedom has undoubtedly led to compromises that are beneficial to the nation, I would add, if we can't maintain the balance among the strained compromises, if some sides turn more to violence to gain the upper hand, it may prove to be the downfall of the nation. In my mind, a nation cannot survive if the citizens do not have a strong concept of the common good, of we're all in this together. The founders didn't sever our bonds with England because they thought we should all have absolute freedom without responsibility for our neighbors or for the common good. Most Americans are familiar with the beginning part of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But we seldom hear reference to the final line of the Declaration, which reads, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, defines our freedoms, at least in relation to the government, as individuals and as citizens of states. Unfortunately, many people have forgotten that those freedoms always come with attached responsibilities. They carry with them the consequences of our choices. Eleanor Roosevelt said, freedom makes a huge requirement of every human being. With freedom comes responsibility. For the person who is unwilling to grow up, the person who does not want to carry their own weight, this is a frightening prospect. Those who want to preserve our freedoms understand our responsibility to each other and heed that responsibility without government enforcement. When citizens pretend they have only freedoms and no responsibilities, this is when the government has to step in like a parent and remind people there are consequences to their choices. When they have to step in like insisting we wear a mask in the midst of a pandemic, or that we not play with fireworks in the midst of extreme fire danger. It is not a violation of personal liberty to expect people to carry their share of the burden of responsibility for the welfare of all. It is not a violation of personal liberty to expect people to treat others, even others who are different in some way, with respect and compassion. If we want our society, our nation, to survive, responsible conduct is part of the social compact to which all members of a free society must agree. So freedom is not a simple subject at all. It's not a lack of responsibilities, but an engagement with those responsibilities that come with the freedoms. Shifting gears a little bit now and turning to Ursula Le Guin's stories as illustrations. Le Guin's stories often deal with responsibility for the choices the characters have made in their social and economic structures and how those affect the suffering of people and sometimes other living beings and ecosystems. They often give us a chance to see our own society through the eyes of a fictional society. For example, her 1974 novel, The Dispossessed, which won both Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Science Fiction Novel, compares life under two different societies. The story takes place on twin planets, which revolve around each other. But the two planetary societies totally distrust each other, don't even communicate. The planet Eurus is green and fertile. It was settled long before by humans, and over time, some of its inhabitants evolved into a warlike, socially stratified, capitalist society with great wealth, but also great poverty. Then there was an attempted revolution by an anarchist group that rejected the capitalist, what they called propertarian values. The rebels moved to the other planet, Inaris, which was a desert planet with few resources, and the settlements remained very poor even a couple of centuries later. The anarchists build a socialist society that's run by syndicates who coordinate production of what they need. In theory, the inhabitants are free of state rule, free from possessions, because everything is shared, free from competitive capitalism. On this planet, the protagonist, Shevik, a theoretical physicist, starts out as an idealist committed to the frugal, humble way of life. Being responsible for one another is our freedom, is what he tells his friends. Over the course of the story, which covers about 40 years, his idea of freedom gets a lot more complicated. As he experiences the system in practice, he sees its hypocrisy. The customs of his people hinder change and free will. The syndicates draft people from their real jobs and send them away from their families to work where labor is needed. When he gets back to doing physics from a long interlude of laboring in the desert, Shevik decides now that true freedom is just being responsible for himself and his work. He's working on a very important theory that could benefit most people in the universe, but he's torn between responsibility of completing that work and the responsibility he feels to his people and their principles. He realizes that his theory is not valued by his people, and his people are not really free at all. He travels instead to authoritarian Eurus, the other planet, to finish his work, and he temporarily thinks he's found freedom in the relative luxury where he's kept. But others there want to steal his theory because it would be very valuable to them, and he realizes that he's basically imprisoned while he finishes the theory. Eventually, he manages to return home after giving his theory to an outside group of humans who he hopes will use it for good in the universe. He realizes along the way that true freedom, simple, ideal, childlike freedom, doesn't exist. It's always much more complex and can be seen from so many different viewpoints at once. Another Le Guin novel, published a few years later, continued to explore different faces of freedom. In The Eye of the Heron, we again find two settlements of immigrants from Earth, this time on the same planet. The original immigration was made up of prisoners exiled to the planet Victoria. Their settlement has grown into a large, powerful city. Outside the city is the town inhabited by exiled pacifists, who are peasant farmers. The farmers provide the food for the city, and the city provides tools and other manufactured goods to the farmers. Seems like a nice harmony, but it's not really that harmonious underneath. The city bosses tend to rule everything with an iron hand. And at this point, they would like to take over the farms and combine them into larger farms, each growing one single crop for the sake of efficiency. And the plan is that the peasants would work for them. The peace-loving farmers are not at all happy with this idea, and a group of them want to move to another valley where they can be more independent. The city bosses use this as an excuse to come down hard on the farmers. There are certainly parallels in this situation with the early settlement of this country by oppressed people who then had to throw off colonial rule. All the town people want is their freedom, political, economic, and social. There's more going on there too. The city is totally ruled by men. Women have no rights or are not even educated. The daughter of one city boss is very unhappy with being considered an object existing only to be married and bear children. Soon the political situation escalates to marches, strikes, and confrontations. The pacifists take their tactics from Earth heroes like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. The daughter decides to escape to find her personal freedom among the farmers, although she wishes they were not quite so peaceful. She ends up convincing them that they can find their freedom on their own terms. They don't have to copy systems that worked on Earth. And eventually she leads them off into the wilderness to establish their new independent settlement. Those are just a couple of Le Guin's stories that explore ideas of human freedom by contrasting political, economic, and social structures. Her anarchist societies are always presented as ambiguous and never ideal, and are generally seen confronting hyper-capitalist authoritarian regimes. So the concept of freedom is very complex and brings up all kinds of questions that different individuals would answer differently. What are the limits of freedom? How much control should a government have over individuals? Are laws obstacles to freedom, or do they make freedom possible, or both? There are positive freedoms, freedoms to do something, and negative freedoms, freedom from something. We could do a whole series of sermons just on different varieties of freedom. The essence of freedom is not just in demanding our rights, but in respecting the rights of others and meeting the responsibilities on which all our freedom rests and on which the survival and health of our nation depends. Maintaining freedom hinges on the common efforts of all of us as citizens and individuals. May it be so, and enjoy your 4th of July.